Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Boker Tov. Good morning and welcome back. And as I started to say, I suspect you heard this, but I'm not sure. We have a full house here physically as well. That's unusual, but we're thankful for that. And we're going to talk today about a number of things, but primarily at least centered on some of the concepts that come from the Torah portion called Tazria. And I just had the question. I answered it again last night, too, but I usually begin by pointing out that this is from Leviticus chapter 12, and it begins by saying, "And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, speak unto the children of Israel." And finally, we get to the part where something is different than the normal text. So the word that is used for the parsha's name comes from here. Or sometimes that means when, and in this case, when is probably a better translation. When a woman is delivered or conceives and then has a baby, and she bears, well, we see two different cases, two different kinds of babies, either a male child or a female child, then various things happen. And the difference, of course, is how long this period of tahorati, how long she is unclean. And I don't like that word, and that's one of the things we're going to start with. So a number of concepts and things to discuss here, but basically I want to address this right up front. Because I heard this at least several times from people both locally over the last few times we've talked about this, and certainly you'll see it if you look online and read the discussions. This is boring. And why do we care about all of this? It's not relevant. Besides which, it's confusing too. All right. Well, I'm going to address the issue of the confusing part, and especially the not relevant part. And I guess I'm going to say it's arguably in some sense more relevant than ever. It's just that there are some aspects of the way these things play out that is different, and that's why it's important. But let's start with the idea of the confusing stuff. Because, well, for one, we know this is politically incorrect. Wait a minute. When a woman delivers a child, how the heck can she be unclean? Isn't this a thing that's wonderful and joyful and good? Well, yeah, it is. It's about bringing new life into the world. So why the heck does Scripture talk about her being unclean for a period of time and then having this time of separation, blood of purification? What does all that mean? It does talk about circumcision in here, which, of course, much of Christianity teaches. Oh, that's all done away with, too. A whole lot of stuff that we got to address. Now, some of this I went through in more detail last night, so I'm not going to focus too much on some of the aspects, for example, of circumcision and the fact that if I had a male child today, I would absolutely positively continue to do exactly what Scripture says to do, which is to circumcise him, and to do so not in the hospital on the first day or wherever, but on the eighth day. One of the things that I think is always fascinating is if you actually look at, and science now is beginning to realize that there are certain things that happen in a baby if they don't mess them up with all kinds of injections right away anyway, and that is that the immune system grows and cycles, the pain receptors, all of these kind of things have their own cycle. And it turns out that if you look at those various cycles, the optimal day to perform a Brit Milah, a circumcision, surprise, surprise, is the eighth day. And isn't it amazing that the woman who delivers the young male child has this idea of being tamei. I always have to think about those a second. Tamei. She's tamei for 7 days. And then she's able to go, of course, to the Brit Milah and have this period of joy, even though there's some blood of purification that continues. So first question, we'll deal with this one briefly. Why is it that it's twice as long for a female as it is for a male, other than the obvious fact that that's what it says? And that's good enough. And we're going to spend some more time coming back to this concept. It's going to be something that I'm going to address several times throughout this after I lay out some of the concepts and make sure it's clear where we're coming from today. A lot of this has to do with life. And there is a difference. Now remember, it's the female that brings the new life into the world. And so it kind of makes sense in a way. I guess the simple explanation for the factor of two is the following. Now bear in mind that when I give an explanation, even though these are explanations that I've read and listened to and think, okay, that kind of makes sense to me, so I'll pass it along. This is not, thus speaks Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. The explanations come from men as to why. We don't know for absolutely positively sure why, but some of this at least makes sense. So this is Markology, if you will. This is kind of how I think things make sense. These are things I've heard, and again, they're worth passing along as long as we understand they're not directly from Scripture. They're just our human explanations for why it might be. And one of those goes something like this. When a young male is born, he has the ability to deliver, when he grows up, seed. He is a little seed manufacturing facility. But the seed is literally manufactured. There's lots and lots and lots that's going to be delivered over the lifetime of this young baby, this young male. On the other hand, when the young female is born, she literally has within her all of the eggs that she's ever going to have for her whole life. Those eggs are a finite quantity, not trillions and trillions like it is with the male. So essentially the explanation goes something like this. If we understand that Tahor and Tameh, and again, this is the part I'm going to come back to over and over again. No, it's not ritual purity and impurity. It's not necessarily clean and unclean, although that does depend a lot on context. There are contexts where the word Tahor and Tameh literally just can mean clean and unclean. But in this case, I'm going to suggest there's something more to it. And the problem is, part of the reason why this is boring and not relevant and confusing is because we don't understand what the words mean in the Hebrew. If you think it's bad so far, wait till we get to leprosy, right? Which is not the same thing at all that we call leprosy. It's not what you see in the movies. The disease that is being described here, the plague, we don't even know what it really is. But one thing I'll guarantee you, it's not the Hansen's disease. It's not the thing that it is described otherwise. So let's just get this one thing straight. I'm going to try to get rid of the English words and use the Hebrew. Because, you know, words mean things and people have baggage that's associated with words. And if we don't understand the words, or we think we do, we're still, and it's wrong, well, then we get the wrong idea. And things seem confusing that shouldn't be. They seem boring because we don't understand what it's supposed to be talking about anyway. So again, we'll come back to leprosy. But if nothing else, I want to try to get us to think in terms of this idea of Tahor and Tameh as two opposite extremes of something that we have more difficulty putting our English-speaking heads around. And it seems to have to do... And I like this term. It actually just kind of came to me in the last 24 hours. I'm not going to claim it's unique. I've probably heard it somewhere else. But literally, Tahor and Tameh, kind of like a life force and a death force. Okay? So think of it that way. Clean and unclean, impurity, ritual purity. Now we're really talking about something that somehow or other in the original language is associated with life. And as you know, there's a force. Adam had life breathed into him. He had a neshama. He became a living nefesh. And all of these things have something to do with life. The essence of the Torah. If there were two words that I would use to describe Torah, it comes from Deuteronomy 30, choose life. Choose life. Choose the Tahor. Choose the life force. And ultimately, the idea of so much that we're seeing in this portion makes a lot more sense if we start to see this in terms of life force and even death force. Now, here I hearken back to my you know, misspent youth and understanding of physics and all that. Because in physics, they'll teach you though there's light, right, and there's darkness. They seem like they're opposites, but they're not really. Life and death, they seem like they're opposites, are they? Really? Well, when it comes to light, we'll tell you that darkness is just the absence of light. And yet now there are some folks saying, no, you know, darkness may really be a physical thing. Darkness might have a physical essence, kind of like lightness does. Well, I'm not sure. But I have a suspicion that when we talk about Tahor and Tameh, there really is a death force and a life force. And if you doubt the death force thing, just look at a modern American society. We'll talk about that later. Look what people are putting on their flesh and in honor of and symbolizing and in literally homage to the death force. We got a society that seems to just worship death in a lot of respects. It's a disgusting thing. But it helps us to kind of wrap our English-speaking heads around the idea of Tahor versus Tameh, the life force and the death force. So with that in mind, since I've already kind of given at least one explanation, and I didn't quite finish it, did I, of the difference between a man-child and a woman-child that's born. Why is it that when a mother delivers a baby at all, let's start there, there is a period of being tamei. Not so much unclean. There's a period in which there is a separation from the life force. Now, if you think of it that way, it makes perfect sense, right? Here's a woman. Her body has been changing. She's bringing new life into the world for 9 months. This life has been growing within her. And all of a sudden, one day she delivers the male child, and bang, the life force is now separated. That's a major big deal. The new life is in the world. That's great. It's a time for joy and thanksgiving. But particularly if you go back and look at history, understand that giving birth is also traumatic. And sometimes it results in death. Sometimes neither the baby nor the mother or one or the other survives. So there is a lot of trauma associated with the process. That's one reason for thinking that there could be a separation from the life force. And the other, of course, has to do with the fact that this baby, this life that was in her, is no longer in her. So there's a natural, well, you all heard the term postpartum depression. Even though she nurses the baby and the baby's ideally, hopefully, still there, why, there's a separation in a physical sense, even though it's close, that wasn't there before. So it's natural that there be this idea of tamei, of a separation from a life that was formerly within that's not. But it doesn't last all that long. So we got 33 days for the male child. Well, okay, now let's look at the female child. In the case of the female child, here not only is a separation from a life force of the individual that has come out of her body and is now on her own, at least to the extent that she's physically separate, but also all of the life force that that young baby is capable of bringing into the world too. All of her eggs that were already within her, those are now separate too. So it kind of makes logical sense, you know, at least it does to me, that there be a period that is twice as long. Because not only is it her life that has now been separated from the new mother, it's the life of everything that she in turn can bring into the world too. So, might be more than twice, might be less than twice. You know, the 2.1 is the replacement number. Ideally, if all of them survive, it would be twice. You have to have twice as many babies in a couple, right, to make up for the two that are doing it. In any case, it doesn't, I'm going to wave my hands a bit. Is it exactly two? Well, Torah says it is. That's good enough for me. But in any case, when we look at the idea of this life force separation and, separation from life, death, tamei, it kind of makes sense. Now, that's as good of an explanation as I can give. And again, it's not so much important that we understand the why as we just understand, here's Torah telling us something that's true. And we can begin to wrap our heads around that. And of course, what's fascinating is we're going to go from chapter 13 about the things that are happening here when a new life comes into the world, and then talk about something that we can relate to even less. A disease that most of us, or all of us, have never ever seen. There's a lot of clinical description. Sounds like it reads like something from the physician's desk reference or, you know, a freshman text on, what would it be, epidemiology or something like that. And no wonder if we've not seen this and we don't expect to see it that we think it's a little bit strange. But whatever it's talking about here, I'm going to suggest up front, it makes more sense to us if we begin to think about this in terms of a life force and a death force and an idea of separation and something that we need to understand associated with that. And to that extent, even if this disease, even if this plague, really, the Bible describes this as a plague of Zaraat, right? Lose the word leprosy. It ain't leprosy. We don't have an English word that comes really very close to it. So I'm just going to say, leave it in the original language, Zaraat. By the way, this Leviticus 13, verse 2, is the first time the word appears in Scripture. So in context, here we see the word. It gets used a number of times in chapter 13 and in the next chapter 2. And the word is defined by its context, because it's going to tell us. Here's what it looks like. It's got to do with a spot on the skin, a flesh rising, or a scab, or a bright spot. Sometimes there's hairs in it. Sometimes it grows. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's a depression, and so forth and so on. Sometimes the color changes. All of these things are important, but the main thing to recognize is whatever this is, this Zara'at, now we're going to get a description about it, and we're also going to find out some things about it that are really, really interesting and very different from, well, a lot of other diseases, including Hansen's disease, modern leprosy, and so forth. Now, I've heard some discussion over the years. People will say, well, you know, it's a skin irritation. Arguably, it may or may not have been painful. We don't get a lot of indication on that score. But we know that it can be very contagious or certain characteristics. Of all the things I've heard suggested, kind of the one that resonates most with me is, and if you want to go through your Bibles and mark it, I'm not suggesting you do that, but if you have to have an English word, rather than leprosy, try chicken pox. Okay? Now the difference with chicken pox was everybody got it back before they had vaccinations and your immune system gets destroyed. But, a chicken pox was something that would grow on the skin, and it would sometimes result in boils. It would change the skin's texture. It itched and it hurt. And later it would go away. That's good. We're anxious to be rid of it. And it was also very contagious. People didn't have the immunity to this thing. They're likely to get it. And as a matter of fact, if they take the vaccine, they're later on more likely to get it as an adult than they would have been had they gotten it when God designed them to get it and to develop their immune systems as a child. So I'm not suggesting that Zara'at is chicken pox, just that it's probably something that our brains can relate to better. If nothing else, it might help us to think about this thing a little differently than the way that we probably have in the past. So, but before we get here, what I want to do is step back. I'm not going to go through today, at least, all of the specifics about what the priest, the Kohen, is going to look for. If somebody thinks they may have this, about what happens, and so forth, with the exception of a couple of observations that go right back to where we started, with Tahor and Tameh, the life force and the death force. Because let me just ask some questions. I remember the single example that we get in detail in the Torah was Miriam, right? Miriam spoke ill against Moshe. At least that seems to be the issue. And she has this thing come upon her. Her brother Aaron says, let her not be as one dead. Oh, please. He literally prays about that. Well, what does Miriam look like? Her skin turns completely white, pale. She looks dead. So there's one thing we know about this idea of Zara'at is that it can have literally a death pallor look to it. So it looks like death in some sense. All right, that certainly is interesting. Oh, and what's it associated with? Well, it seems to be associated with the death force. The person who gets this is to go around at some point, once they've been declared to have it, and say, Tameh, unclean, unclean, we translate it, but it really is kind of like death force, right? Whoa, that would certainly keep people away if you shout death force. No doubt Tameh probably had a similar effect. Now, where I want to go next is back to this original idea, Tahor and Tameh, life force and death force, and start asking some questions about if we summarize what we see in chapter 13 here, what does it suggest to us? And lots of people have made this connection. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at a nice article by Rabbi Ari Kahn. He says, look, if you look at the parallels, especially in Hebrew, it's undeniable, unmistakable. But it helps us to see what's going on here. If you look and see how the Torah describes the metzora, I didn't mention that term today yet, the metzora is the person who has Zara'at. Zara'at. And, of course, you'll also hear this. Most Hebrew speakers will say, oh, yeah, that word metzora, it sounds like a lot like the word motzei ra, which is to bring forth ra, badness, evil. To bring forth evil. How do you do that? Well, we'll come back to that. You'll even hear Motzei Shemra, to bring forth an evil name. But Motzei Ra, Metzora, yeah, there's more than a casual similarity there. And that takes us to this next similarity and interesting contrast. So here's what the Torah says about the person who is a metzora, has zara'at. The Kohen, the priest, is the one that makes the determination, literally declares him to be tahor. I'm sorry, tamei. And he also, when the time comes, gets to declare him to be tahor too. So, quote, when a person is declared unclean, tamei, has this mark of zara'at, his clothing must be torn. He is to go without cutting his hair, without a haircut, and he is to cover his head down to his lips and shout, of course, tamei, tamei. As long as he has this mark, the mark of death, if you will, he is to remain and to be referred to as tamei. And since he is tamei, he is also to be alone. And his place is outside the camp. Now, the camp is tahor. The camp is what? It's a place of life. It's a place where people that have been brought out of bondage, out of a kind of a living death of bondage to a different set of gods, are going to be brought into a land flowing with milk and honey, a land that is literally the symbol of life, kind of a new Eden. Not quite, but close. All of those things literally are another way of looking at this difference between coming out of death and into life. And so when somebody is going in the other direction, what do you do with them? You put them out of the camp. All right, let's go through this again. We've got several things. This person is tamei, unclean. They tear their clothing. They go without a haircut. They cover their heads. They make this call out of tamei, tamei, and they are outside the camp and alone. So let's go back and ask, what about the situation we talked about just a couple portions ago? When the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, die, they were in the Mishkan itself, literally the set-apart place, the holy place, and Moshe instructs them not to mourn for what happened. He says to Aaron and his sons, the sons that are surviving, Eleazar and Ithamar, do not, hear the contrast, do not go without a haircut. Do not tear your clothes. Those are often things that are associated with this idea of grieving for the dead. Otherwise, you will die and bring literally the wrath of Yah upon the entire community. The entire family of Israel is going to mourn for those whom Elohim has burned. But literally, if you do the comparison and ask, well, what about the Kohen too? The Kohen, especially when he's trying to serve in the holy place, he is not to be associated with death. Everything about him speaks of life. To a great extent, the parallel that I want to make sure we understand here is just as there's this opposites between the life force and the death force, between the tahor and the tamei, there is an opposite thing going on here between the metzora, the one who has zara'at, and the kohen. The essence of what the kohen does is with life. It's the inverse. Now, with that in mind, I want to do one other thing, and that's quickly to turn to a place in Book of Ezekiel. This is one of the prophets speaking. Ezekiel chapter 44. And we're going to talk some more about the Kohanim, the priests. And we already know what the Torah says, because the Torah gives us a lot of descriptions. I've already read just one of them here this morning. But chapter 44 of Ezekiel has to do with, among other things, the instruction, the Torah concerning the Levites, the Kohanim. And it says in verse 10, for example, when the Levites went far from me, when Israel went astray. Remember, we have this split. The northern kingdom was not only went astray, its priests failed, and they were what? They were put away. They were shalacked. They were sent outside. They strayed. They went after their idols. They're to bear their iniquity. Because those folks who did this thing ministered to them before their idols, and they caused the whole house of Israel to fall into iniquity. Therefore, I have raised my hand in an oath against them, says Yahuwah Eloheka, that they shall bear their own iniquity, and they will not any more come near to minister to me as Kohen, as a priest. They blew it. Now, what have they done? They've chosen idolatry. Literally, what the essence of Torah tells us is they have chosen death over life. So they're not going to be a Kohen anymore. They're not going to come near to me in my most set apart things, in the holy things, nor are they going to come into the holy place, but they're to bear their shame and the abominations, their abominations, which they have committed. There are still some things that are going to happen. It talks about the Levites, the sons of Zadok, keep charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray. They're to come near me to minister. They will stand before me to offer the fat and the blood. They'll enter my sanctuary and keep my charge and take care of my table. And there's some more description on that score. But what I want to do is I want to focus on verse 23. Oh, I will mention verse 20. It says here, when these folks, the ones who are still going to do things, they're not to clothe themselves with things that make sweat. When they go out into the outer court to their people, they take off their ministering garments, leave them in the holy chambers, put on other garments. They're not to shave their heads, nor let their hair grow long, just keep themselves nicely trimmed. It has a description of who they're allowed to take as an Isha, as a wife, not someone who is who has been divorced. Only virgins are these folks allowed to take, descendants of the house of Israel, or, one exception, the widows of the Kohanim. But verse 23 is the one I want to focus on for a second. This is something I mentioned in a lot of contexts anyway, but I think it's especially important in this context. They are to teach my people the difference between the Kadosh, the holy, the set apart, and the profane, and they are to cause them to discern. Oh, discrimination is bad. We don't do discrimination. Well, bull. We don't because we haven't been taught it. We've been taught the wrong thing. This sounds familiar, doesn't it? In other words, choosing death over life. If the Kohen were doing their jobs, if the priests were doing their jobs, if the popes were doing their jobs, if the preachers and others that were supposed to be doing this kind of thing were doing their jobs, people would discern the difference between the tahor and the tamei, between the clean and the unclean. This is Ezekiel 44, verse 23. Now think about that. The priests are not only supposed to be able to do it. What is the whole essence of chapter 13 here? It's about discerning. It's about giving us a whole bunch of instruction, or at least the Kohen of that time, giving him instruction as to how it is you'd be able to look upon somebody and then declare, pronounce that this person is either tahor or tamei, headed in life direction or death direction. And we're supposed to be able to be taught. That's the function of the Kohen, is to teach the difference between not only the set apart and the profane, but also the tahor and the tamei. In controversy, it goes on to say they're to stand as judges according to my judgments, keep my statutes, judgments, commandments, and, oh, they're to also hallow my Sabbaths. And they're not to defile themselves by coming near a dead person. Only for a father, mother, son, or daughter, in other words, a very, very close relative, can they defile themselves. Somehow or other, the essence of this is the priests, the Kohanim, they're supposed to teach the difference, they're supposed to proclaim the difference in the situation we're talking about now, and they're supposed to know it enough that with very rare exceptions for very close relatives, they are literally to stay as far away from death and things associated with death as possible. And I guess, at least to my mind, I hope this is helpful to folks, when I begin to look at things this way and think about, you know, ritual purity, ritual impurity, it's all that old temple jazz, doesn't make any difference. Anyway, got no temple to go into. Question came up last night, right? What things can the woman who is in this period of time, what can she not touch? And other than maybe her husband during that period of separation, there isn't much. In a land that has been put away and doesn't have the set-apart things, doesn't have a temple or a mishkan or any of that kind of stuff, there isn't much that she can't touch anyway. And, you know, during the days that we're talking about, when the Kohanim were around, and maybe these were wives or daughters or sisters of the Levites or the descendants of Zadok, maybe she might be given something that was set-apart food to eat. Something that was sanctified. Well, you know, that really doesn't matter either. So no, it's not relevant today. Well, yeah, It's not relevant to the extent that those things aren't around and the places that they couldn't go aren't around to talk about. But I'm still going to suggest the essence of this is every bit as important, if not more now than it ever was. If we don't discern the difference between life and death, between those things that lead to life and those things that lead to death, we got a world of hurt. Now, we're going to talk in a while about some of the things going on in the world, but basically, the point I want to make now, and I think it'll be more and more obvious if it's not already, look at the world today. It chooses death on a daily basis. Hell, we got people that are planning on killing 6 or 7 billion folks if they get their way. Can you think of a more dramatic illustration of choosing of death? You've got people that are being lied to about stuff that's not food, whether it's pig and shellfish or genetically modified frankenfoods that'll destroy your immune system. All kinds of stuff we'll inject you with. Not going to tell you that it's full of mercury and thimerosal and other things and might cause more harm than good. No, no, we worship at the great god science, even if it doesn't have anything to do with the science that was once talked about as the scientific method. What's science nowadays? Well, it's just a god. It's just something that we proclaim our allegiance to, even if people who do so are so ignorant of what the word actually means that they haven't got a clue what science is. It's just some other god they worship. All right, back to the life force and the death force, because I hope at least that that's being made clear. Oh, and by the way, let me say this again, too. We got the lag again to deal with, but if there are questions, local questions, here in person or online, either one, we'll do those. The folks in person have an advantage, and that is no one-minute lag between the time that I see the question and the time that it appears on the screen. All right, now, the other thing that is problematic, and again, I a lot of times, as you know, on Friday night, I'll go through the Torah portion kind of from start to finish and talk about the specifics, and then on Shabbat day, I tend to be a little bit more freewheeling and try to connect dots that may go all over the place. And those of you that have listened on Shabbat know, we might very well go anywhere on Shabbat because there are a lot of connections that you can't make in the time that it takes just to go through the specifics of the Torah. But as I'm thinking about this concept of Zara'at, the person who has it, the Metzora, and somehow or other this association with life and death, and the fact that everything about the Zara'at, the disease, the plague, and really plague is the word that Scripture uses. It's a plague. By the way, where do plagues come from? Plagues seem to come from Elohim. Unless, of course, you're counting the man-made stuff that you take pig genes, mix them with bird flu genes, and create all kinds of wonderful bioweapons because you intend to kill millions or billions, right? Here's where things get a little bit more difficult and why I think it's so important that we spent the time up front talking about the words themselves. Because we don't see this disease, this plague, Zara'at, anymore. What we do see is the things that cause it. At least the things that have been said to cause it. That's where I'm working my way up closely. So let me just say this as bluntly as I can. Once upon a time, I heard what most of you all have heard. Lashon Hara, the evil tongue, gossip, causes Zara'at. We've probably heard it said it causes leprosy. Now, that is, in fact, a very rabbinic teaching. And as a general rule, I'll be very careful about things like that. And indeed, I'm going to be careful today to say, yeah, can I prove that from Scripture? Well, we've already talked about a lot of indications of it. We can certainly see what happened with Aaron's and Moshe's sister, Miriam. She seems to have spoken ill about Moshe, and it seems to have caused a problem. Can we say, because the Scripture come up and say, I gave her, this plague because. It doesn't, really. It does seem like a fairly clear dot to connect. But once upon a time, I was more than a little cautious about this. I've put the name on the screen. Some of you will have heard the name of a famous rabbi. And I recommend the book. It's a great book if you've not heard of it. It's called A Lesson a Day. And last night I knew it was something about I knew it had to do something with lessons for days, but couldn't remember the exact title of the book. Anyway, looked it up this morning. And if we can't find the book in the box somewhere, I need to go buy another copy, because this is a good book. It's by a rabbi who, like the Rambam and like Rashi and others, has a teaching name, kind of a nom de plume, that is a different name than the one that he was given. But everybody knows this guy as the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim. Because he is the author of record when it comes to Motzei Shem Ra, Motzei Ra, and of course Lashon Hara. The whole book, A Lesson a Day, is all about what is Lashon Hara and how to avoid it. So, in other words, if you want to call the Bible for Lashon Hara and how to avoid it, it's the book that was written by the Chofetz Chaim. Let me just say it, he makes a pretty convincing case that Lashon Hara is a very bad thing. And let's talk for just a second, because what I'm going to suggest to you is, while I can't prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt in a court of law or even in a court of Torah, and therefore I'm going to say, hey, this is me, Markology-wise, saying, having been through the Torah a bunch of times, I accept that the dot connection looks pretty solid. In other words, it's a convincing case that can be made. So am I going to tell you that Lashon Hara causes Za'ara? No. For several reasons. A, because I can't prove it from Scripture absolutely and positively. B, because it doesn't. Because we don't see Za'ara anymore, but we got all kinds of Lashon Hara. Hey, what's going on there? If it caused it, there ought to still be a lot of it, because we still got a lot of Lashon Hara. A lot of gossip, a lot of evil tongue, people defaming one another, people destroying lives and communities, people bearing false witness, you name it, stuff's coming out of people's mouths and causing death and destruction. Don't look any farther than the Oval Office for that. I mean, we got all kinds of wickedness from high places literally washing over this land and causing, too, this choice of death over life. Why is it that you think people would want to decorate themselves with pictures that are tattooed into their skin that are, you know, skulls and crossbones and things that are symbolic of death? Something really wicked is going on there. Maybe that's the modern version, right, of Zaraat. You see somebody covered with pictures of death, they ought to go around shouting, Tomei! No, Tomei! Tomei! Anyway. All of that brings me to a couple of things. One of which, and this is another place where I think that some of the rabbinic information is fairly solid. And it goes something like this. This spiritual affliction, Zaraat, and that's what the claim is that it is. Not so much a physical thing, it has a physical manifestation, but it really is a spiritual thing. It's like what comes out of a man's mouth, what comes out of their heart, literally boils up through their skin and causes it to rot, causes these various things. And it's contagious, just like gossip is. Hey, no doubt on that score, right? You're looking for some of these connections, at least, that you say, well, it's circumstantial, but sure is a lot of it. Yep, that's one of them. So the connection is clear. Can I make the case that it is an explicitly spiritual affliction? Well, no, but I'm willing to go there. I'm willing to accept that that's the case. So here's where we are. The claim goes something like this. Zaraat is a blessing that the creator of the universe miraculously bestows on his people that are set apart in his name for his purposes. In other words, like the Exodus, when these people have been delivered by a mighty hand, brought through the split of the sea, and they're headed towards, even if it's going to take a while, the land that was promised to them. Somehow or other, they're set apart, and he is going to protect them from the death and destruction caused by things becoming overly tamei, the death force, by putting this affliction upon them. Literally, those he loves, he chastens. You keep talking like that, I'm going to chasten the living you-know-what out of you. I'll chasten you some more. All right? Your skin's going to get really ugly. You're going to be put outside the camp which is where that kind of thing belongs. My camp is supposed to be clean. You're going to let, well, I'll say it bluntly, you're going to let poop issue forth from your mouth? Where does that supposed to go? That's supposed to be outside the camp. You too, get outside the camp with that. Those he loves, he chastens. And at some point, when the whole camp becomes defiled, or when we are sent into exile because of all this Tamaic crap that kept flowing out, from idolatry to other kinds of wickedness to all kinds of things that he says aren't pleasing to me, I'm gonna kick you out. I told you I was going to do this. He did it to the northern kingdom first. Later, he did it to the southern kingdom as well. Well, you know what? The disease, the plague of Zaraat is gone. Because you're living in it. The whole place you're in is Tamei. Doesn't need any more death force proof because it's there. It's all over you. It's written on your faces. Comes out of your mouths. Well, let me pause and make one other connection. Now, this is one that honestly don't think I've heard this mentioned before. I don't know why not, because as I think about it, it's downright obvious. And I've taught on this for year after year. A lot of times I like to point out that you go through Torah year after year, and every year you'll see something you go, why didn't I notice that before? But I talk about Numbers chapter 5. Some of you old men will remember this. This is the remedy for the jealous husband. This is a place in the Torah where it says that if a man has this concern, he might be right, he might be wrong, but he has a concern that his wife has gone astray. She has committed adultery. She has lain with another man. Bad thing. This is literally a sin deserving of death. But he doesn't know. Because you know what? Here's part of the problem with some of the things in Torah. Matter of fact, everything in Torah that brings a death penalty requires, right? No one is to be put to death except on the testimony of two or three witnesses. We know the story from Yeshua. I've talked about this a lot, about the woman that was allegedly, and I say that because clearly there's something wrong with their story, allegedly caught in the very act of adultery. Well, if that's true, for crying out loud, where's the man? The point, though, is adultery requires two or more witnesses to the actual fact. How often do you think that's going to happen? Right? Gonna go into the hotel room with the guy here, leave the door open, and do it on camera. Well, you know, in a modern American situation, I don't doubt that there's probably TV shows feature that. But short of that, it doesn't happen. Short of that, in other words, you don't have two witnesses to adultery. Period. I mean, it just, particularly in biblical times, it's not gonna happen. Oh, we're thinking about committing a crime that's worthy of death. I wanna make sure there's enough witnesses to kill us both. Right? Not gonna happen. So adultery, while it is a really serious thing, isn't almost ever going to be penalized in the way that Torah says. But one of the things that you'll see the Midrash talk about is that adultery, along with pride and some of the other so-called seven deadly sins, are among the things, and of course Lashon Hara at the top of the list, that can cause, or did cause, Zaraat. Somebody to become a Metzora. Now, where am I headed with all of this? Zaraat was a physical manifestation of a spiritual issue, of something that is a direct precursor to death. In other words, you choose death somehow or other, and it manifests itself physically. When it comes to adultery, very serious crime, two witnesses required. You almost never see that. And therefore, in Scripture, Numbers chapter 5, you have this remedy for the jealous husband. He suspects, maybe he knows, but he can't prove it, that she has committed adultery. And I'm not going to belabor the entire thing, because I think it's just a wonderful teaching associated with Numbers chapter 5. But here's the key to it. It is said by the Torah scholars, the rabbis, the sages, and I agree because I can't refute it, that the remedy for the jealous husband is the only such specific ritual procedure process that you will see described in the Torah where it requires a specific direct intervention from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh for the miracle that follows to happen. All right? What are we talking about with the process? Remember, the man has a suspicion. He brings his wife before the Kohen. There's a procedure that he goes through. The curses are written. The dust from the floor of the temple is scooped up. He makes this drink, puts it in the cup. The woman takes the cup. She declares an oath, and then she drinks it. And one of two things happen. If she's guilty, her thigh rots and her belly swells. And that might, in fact, cause her death. On the other hand, if she is not guilty, what happens? And, oh, isn't this interesting? Does it connect back to what we're talking about today? You betcha. If she is innocent, there is restoration of right relationship with her husband. And miraculously, she brings forth a child. She becomes pregnant. How did this portion begin? What are we talking about here? New life! Out of a time of suspicion of a crime that is guilty of literally something deserving death comes restoration of right relationship and joy and, of course, new life. How much better than that can it get? So here you have something that literally requires the creator of the universe to intervene directly. Oh, it too, just like what we're talking about this week, requires things that don't exist, right? Requires us to be in right relationship, requires the presence of the Kohanim, requires the temple. Can't happen. Can't do it. We don't got Zara'at either. But this too, this spiritual malady, this plague is kind of very similar to the remedy for the jealous husband in that. But now we're not talking about an individual miracle. We're talking about literally a miracle for the entire society, right? A miraculous chastening of people who commit these sins that lead to death, up to and including Lashon Hara, will bring forth this spiritual manifestation in a physical sense. So I don't know about you. To me, I thought that's just downright amazing. And in both cases, in the remedy for the jealous husband, and in the case of the Metzora, we don't see it anymore. And I guess I'll draw this parallel too. So what do we got, right? We got adultery on a literally biblical scale, infesting an entire society. And we've got Lashon Hara on a biblical scale, infesting an entire society. And not only that, really, what I would suggest we have is we have the Tamei, we have the death force running amok, infesting an entire society. And it's arguably like nothing we've ever seen before. Does it make sense? I'm going to throw this out there and postulate it, because I've already said, okay, I accept the relationship between Lashon Hara and Zara'at, and the fact that Lashon Hara is a nasty thing, it's an infectious thing, it has something really clear to do with the death force. And if the creator of the universe hadn't withdrawn his hand of chastening, both for the individual woman in adultery and the man that's doing it with her, and in the sense of the Zara'at, the plague for this spiritual crime, we'd be in a heck of a lot better place. We'd be in a lot cleaner place. We're not there. All right, well, back to the way we started this. Oh, this is boring. It's not relevant. It's really confusing. We haven't got leprosy, unclean, clean. That doesn't make any sense. Well, if we recognize that what we're talking about here is literally the difference between life and death, blessing and cursing, and the fact that we have a whole, not just a generation, but at least 1,700 years of so-called priests who have failed to teach what were my people the difference between the set apart and the profane. Hey, they think bunnies and eggs to celebrate the death and resurrection in the most important event in history can be renamed after a pagan goddess, and all of that somehow is pleasing? Talk about choosing death rather than life. The essence of what was done was all about life, and you get people celebrating it with idolatry. How's that for a disconnect? it's kind of funny. I guess now I'll throw this out there since I'm speculating a bit. If, in fact, the creator of the universe was to decide all of a sudden to bring back Zara-At, there'd be a whole lot of people running around with, chicken pox the day after Ishtar Sun God Day. I don't know. Somehow or other, we've witnessed the bitter fruit of what happens when people no longer have the direct intervention, miraculously, the chastening, even the plagues of the Almighty. Now, we know, at least I submit, this is another one of those things where Scripture tells us prophetically, and I think not only does it tell us through the prophets that we're gonna look forward, and we've talked about this several times over the last few weeks too, to this greater exodus yet to come, a greater regathering. Not only that, there's a whole bunch of plagues going to come as part of that. And I have speculated for years that if we look at the first plagues and we see that they're three sets of three plus one and that they were all judgments against the so-called gods, the mighty ones, the Elohim of Egypt, Mitzrayim, that maybe we can look ahead and say, what are the next three sets of three plus one plagues likely to look like? What kind of gods, right? American Idol, the great god vaccine and big pharma, the great god science that brings you man-made, non-existent global warming. Hey, there's plenty of candidates for the various gods that might get judged. Somewhere along the line, we're going to see a return of Zara-At. Maybe. We're certainly going to see a return of a lot worse things, I have no doubt, because they're being engineered right now in biolabs all over the world that are planning to be unleashed. You know, as the Georgia Guidestone says, we got 6 or 7 billion people that they're really anxious to kill. And you can't do it all with nukes. We want to leave something for the rich men of the earth to keep after they've got them all cleaned out. At least that's what they're thinking. So all of these things at least begin to make sense. Again, key points. Here's why it's not boring and it is relevant. If there's anything that I hope people will take away from this discussion, it's this idea of the life force and the choice that we have between life and death, blessing and cursing, Deuteronomy chapter 30. And somehow or other, we are supposed to learn. We haven't been taught it. Maybe we need to go learn on our own or at least listen to people who will teach it. And I hope to be among those, that there is a big difference between the Tahor and the Tameh. And that whether we have the feedback mechanism, that's what it is. You know, as an engineer, I like to think about feedback mechanisms and difference engines and how it is we can build an autopilot, right, to keep us on course. And if you know you're off course, it's a lot easier than if you're walking around in the dark without a lamp to our feet of Torah. And you haven't got any clue when you're heading right towards the death zone, right over the cliff. So we got to get the light first. We got to make sure that if we're going to make Teshuvah, going to return to Him, that we have enough light to know how to do that. And then, not only is the Torah a lamp to our feet, but somewhere along the line, we're going to have to make sure we can discern between the Tahor and the Tameh. And it's helpful too, again, to return to the pure language, to be able to say, look, clean and unclean. And when I read things like the priest and how does being in a tent with a dead body, right? How does that make me unclean? Well, maybe, you know, I've heard scientists argue that depending upon how the person died, if it's a plague, it could be a communicable disease. And that might in fact cause something where death is communicated. Yeah, I can. All right. Now, there's a spiritual element to this that just says, understand. Tahor and Tameh are bigger than clean and unclean or ritual this or that. These are things that are associated with a force that brings life and a force that brings death. And once we kind of begin to get our heads wrapped around that, I'm going to suggest the rest of this becomes a whole lot more clear. All right, so with that, I'll pause for a second and ask, are there any questions? Because I want to talk about one more important thing that is related to the Torah portion, and it comes right smack out of the apostolic writings. And it's important, and it also has to do with the things we see going on in the world today that, and in the so-called messianic community, and in the community of those who are coming out and going to Torah. And this is one that has bugged me for a long time, so it fits here dramatically, and it's important. All right, because what I want to do next, I want to turn to some really, really good advice about how we can deal with all of this. And this advice is every bit as appropriate now as it ever was on Lashon Hara and what we need to avoid and how we need to deal with one another and so forth. And some of you already know where I'm headed probably. This comes from the book of Matit Yahu, the Taught Ones, the Disciples of Yahu, and it is chapter 18. And the whole chapter literally has to do with things that we're talking about here today. But in particular, there's this. Because the question always comes up, all right, we talked last night, there were questions about, well, is this Lashon Hara, and is that Lashon Hara? And what if somebody does something really, really nasty? You know, if a merchant cheats somebody. Because Lashon Hara doesn't necessarily have to be untrue. The idea of Motse Shemra, that's the Hebrew word, to bring forth a bad name. Motse Shemra. Literally, to defame someone's name, to drag it through the mud. That is generally said to be something that is not true. Defamation of character, character assassination. And that is considered to be the nastiest of the nasty, kind of the grandfather, if you will, of things that are the bringing of Tameh, like the dead body itself. Doesn't get any deader than the dead body. So Motse Shemra, kind of the end of it. But Lashon Hara, gossip. Gossip can be true. Did you hear that Lucy is doing such and such? Yeah. Well, even if it's true, it can cause real problems. And that's the essence, and that's part of the reason why I recommended the book that that the Chofetz Chaim wrote. It's been translated to English, called A Lesson a Day. Because he goes through example after example, and it's really some good stuff in there. There's a narrow path here. How do we do the things we need to do? How, in other words, do we, advise our families and our friends and our wives and our children about somebody does something wrong? You need to understand that, my daughter, or you need to understand that, my wife. But we don't want to participate in it, but we have to be careful about what we say. Even though this person did something wrong, we're going to be careful. We're not going to get sucked into something that is Lashon Hara. And that's not necessarily easy. Again, this idea of a merchant. The merchant cheats somebody, steals from them. And you find out that somebody you know is going to go and deal with that same merchant. Right? How can you advise them, don't do that, without necessarily defaming the name of the merchant or participating in Lashon Hara? Sounds really easy, but it's not as easy as you might think. Well, here is the advice. Again, the advice comes from Matthew chapter 18. And this is about as succinct as it gets. How about if your brother, what's a brother, right? Well, we got other verses that we'll talk about that. How about if your brother, he sins against you? Go, show him his sin between you and him alone. In other words, go privately to this person, and it's not Lashon Hara if you go talk to them directly. If he listens to you, you have gained back your brother. Great. Step one, always go tell him what the problem is, address it privately, and hopefully he will listen. All throughout the book of Proverbs, you see Shlomo talking about the wise man who will accept chastening, who will listen. You know, however, there are people who won't, which is where we get to verse 16 here. But if he does not listen, now take one or two more with you. So, why? We know this right from Torah, right? So that at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. Hash it out. Take witnesses with you. If he still refuses to listen to them, now tell it to the assembly, the kahal, kol edat. And if he refuses to hear the whole assembly also, let him to be to you as a non-believer, as a goyim, or as a criminal, as a tax collector. And it's interesting to me that the next thing that follows is one of these verses that you'll hear people quote. Oh, the Catholic Church is big on this one. Most assuredly, I tell you that whatever you, or whoever you bind on ha'aretz, on the earth, will be bound in the shemayim, ha'shemayim. Whatever you free on earth, they will be freed in ha'shemayim. And then he goes on to say, most assuredly, I tell you that if two of you will agree on ha'aretz, on the earth, concerning anything that they ask of me, it will be done. by Yahuwah, my Father, who is in the Shemayim. Because whenever two or three are gathered together in my name, funny how most people don't even know what that means, much less even, you know, what it is, there am I in the middle of you. All right, then we know where it goes, and here I'll pause. Kepha comes, and he says, hey, Master, how often is this going to happen? If my brother sins against me, must I forgive him? 7 times? We know the answer, right? Nope, up to 70 times 7, I tell you, if he repents. Until 70 times 7. Now, that's the verse that has always bothered me a little bit. He goes on to tell the story about the unfaithful servant and the debt. And the conclusion of the story, if you haven't noted, you know, he is forgiven a small amount. He goes out then and does even a worse thing to those that owe him. And when it's all said and done, his master was very angry. He delivered him to the jailers because, hey, I forgave you a little. You wouldn't, I forgave you a whole lot. You wouldn't even forgive your brothers a little. So verse 35, the end of this chapter says, so my Father in the Shemayim will also do so unto you if you did not each forgive your brother from your heart for his sins against you. So this is serious stuff. It's interesting. Somehow or other, I'm going to suggest that everything we're talking about here literally has to do with a choice of life over death, choosing the life force as opposed to the death force. And another element of this that we've just got to, if nothing else, understand this process, but more particularly understand that it has to do with the things that come out of our mouth. And the fact that somehow or other we got to be very careful, particularly when it comes to spreading a plague of Lashon Hara against people that haven't got anything to do with it. And I read this in a number of ways, okay? That includes, for example, lines of biblical authority. Those of you that have asked me questions privately, I know it comes up frequently. How about a husband and wife? And they're having issues, and they want to go to somebody. Okay, great. Understand, though, that the counselor is not the one that has authority over that covenant relationship. It's the husband that has authority over the covenant. He is the one that is ultimately going to be held responsible. And so, you know, to the extent that me or anybody else that can engage in saying, okay, here's what Torah says, here's what counseling is, that's great. But I think it is important, particularly for teachers and those in a position of presumed authority, and I'm going to put that in underlines and quotations, to be very careful about knowing what the real lines of biblical authority are. You don't mess in a man's house without understanding the situation. And you certainly don't talk about it behind their backs. And you certainly don't do things that would undermine that authority. And, you know, I look at the world today and I look and say, okay, you know that if somebody calls 911 because they overheard an argument in their neighbor's house, and I'm going to be real blunt here, the pigs, not the police, because these are people acting under color of law. Pigs will come, take the people's children away, put a so-called restraining order in place, and destroy a marriage. Is there anything biblical about that? Oh, your neighbor said that he heard an argument going on here. Well, whoop-tee-doo! You're going to destroy a marriage and a covenant because of Lashon Hara? What an evil place we have gotten to be. And most people aren't aware of this, but I can guarantee you in the majority of states in this union, this former union, that is precisely the situation. This is what now is called law. And folks, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the Constitution. And for crying out loud, it sure as hell doesn't have anything to do with the Torah as written. So as you can gather, having seen these destructive things firsthand, all of these are part of the reason why I say when it comes to understanding how insidiously corrosive, malignant is one of the words you'll see in this chapter in the Torah. Some of these things are that are tamei, that are the death force. And what now passes for law and how careful things have to be. The tongue truly is destructive beyond measure. And yeah, you can kill people with guns and nukes and bioweapons. But in terms of the level of destruction, no, I think still, the death force seems to be unleashed by the tongue as much as anything else that I have ever seen or been aware of. All right. From there, let's talk a little bit about, unless there are some questions and no questions. Okay. Let's talk about a few of the things. And in this case, I'm going to say this up front because I always think about it. Yeah, I'm fixing to say some bad things about people in positions of authority who spew Motzei Shemra from their mouths and who wield the imperial pen to destroy the Torah and force the worship of other gods and proclaim certain things to be law, regardless of what the real creator and author of Scripture has to say. And in this particular case, I will suggest that what the Torah says is there are places where we're not to keep silent. The watchman on the wall sees the sword coming upon the land. He better blow the shofar, or his blood, says the Creator, the blood of those who die as a result of your silence, will I require at your hand. So we have a responsibility. In other words, folks, I'm not going to talk, for example, about Barry Sidarko's wielding of the imperial pen to take away what were your rights guaranteed by a creator, or a Hillary Clinton to do the same, or any number of other people who proclaim themselves to be representatives and therefore capable of running your life and choosing your gods better than you can. I'm not going to keep silent on that score. Because there's a lot of false witness that's being born. There's a lot of people proclaiming themselves to have godlike power and authority that don't. And there, of course, there's a lot of folks that, whether we know it or not, via the wickedness that issues from our mouth, via the assent that we give to the death force, that are placing ourselves under the authority of the wrong master. Now, one of the things that that I'll talk about a lot of times, go look at a musical, Damn Yankees, Death Comes, and anyway, it is a popular motif. I can't ever think of the titles on occasion when I'm trying to remember all of these many, many places where you see this idea of somebody makes a deal with the devil, right? The rock and roll star that says, I'll sell my soul if I can be a really rad guitarist, or whatever the case may be. It was a movie came out a few years ago about, Led Zeppelin and Stairway to Heaven and all these things, and saying, you'd be surprised how many of these rock stars, many of them now dead, literally sold their soul in exchange. As a matter of fact, the movie was called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, if you've not seen it. But it's not something that's limited to that. Damn Yankees. The guy wants to be, was it the manager or the home run hitter that sold his soul? I don't remember. But anyway, Damn Yankees gonna win the pennant because somebody sold their soul in order to win the pennant. And they go from being the worst team to, this butt kicking baseball team. Faustus. Is the other famous story in history. Well, anyway, that is, in fact, a motif that goes on. And I honestly think it is consistent with Torah. You can make the deal with the devil. When I talk about constitutional issues and the rights that were once protected, and the story that I sometimes do, I've got it in my stack here. I'll start with it. Because it's so insidiously evil. Here it is. We'll do it first. This is not how I planned on doing it, but hey, that's the way it works. Hillary Clinton. I'm very careful to pronounce that name correctly. If you go look at the parallels, you'll see what I mean. She said on Meet the Depressed over the weekend that, quote, the unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights. Now, that is a very Clintonian statement. Remember, the Clintonian statement is you have to parse the words very carefully and explicitly. Humpty Dumpty, to Alice in Wonderland, said, a word means exactly what I want it to mean, nothing more and nothing less. It is about who is to be master. That is all. And the infamous Bill Clinton once upon a time said, it all depends on what the meaning of the word is. And so here is Hitlery coming right out. Now, this is the part that's going to surprise folks. This is the raw, unvarnished Clintonian truth. Is it the way it should be? No. Is she telling you that once you make the deal with the devil, aha, gotcha? Damn Yankees, damn right. The unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights. What does it mean? Well, if you go to the 14th Amendment, A friend, an acquaintance of mine likes to call it the Red Amendment, because it's the essence of America having taken the road towards death and towards literally communism. The Red Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. That's where the U.S. citizen concept was created, literally penned into existence, and of the state wherein they reside. Now, there's enough loopholes and evil there to drive many, many, many trucks through. The line that I'll use just to summarize it is, this goes to show you what happens when you give lawyers 200 years to find runarounds and loopholes and ways to avoid the simple prohibitions of thou shalt not and Congress shall make no law. Answer? What it does is defines a whole different class of person. The citizen of the United States is a person subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And if you go read the rest of the so-called law, you see, wow, what's being done there? They literally created this second-class citizen and said, you know what? Once upon a time, there were people, we the people, who were created in the image of God. They have a soul. They have a neshama and a nefesh. And they were given rights by their creator. As John Adams and Franklin and Jefferson all famously said, rights that cannot be taken away by any power on earth. However, they can be given away. You can make the deal with the devil. You can choose to serve another god. And you can turn to any of 100 places in Scripture, like Isaiah 66 and others, where he says, hey, they made their choice, they have their reward. You made your bed, you lie in it. I will choose their delusions, said the prophet Isaiah for Elohim, because they chose that in which I do not delight. All right? You can choose. Well, here's Hitler saying, and quoting correctly, that 14th Amendment says all persons, there's that word. See, what's a person? A person is a creation of another god. Do you doubt that? Pick up any law dictionary. Pick up any of the various commentaries on the law. IBM is a person. Microsoft is a person. What is a person? A person is a fictional entity, a creation of the state. It has privileges and immunities given to it by its creator. It has a name, the IBM Corporation. It has certain privileges and immunities. It can enter into contracts. IBM can enter into contracts. You can enter into contracts. It can be found guilty of certain crimes, and it can't be killed because it has no soul. That's how come you get too big to fail and too big to jail. But essentially, what is it? Now, here's the question. Can we the people become a person? We have a name. We have a soul. Matter of fact, I've mentioned this before. You go to the FAA and the flight plan forms that I used for 30 years now. It says under all this stuff, right, name of the airplane, name of the, you know, where it's coming from, where it's going to, how much fuel on board, how many souls on board. Doesn't say how many persons on board. Says how many souls on, because persons don't have souls. Souls, however, is explicit. That's how many living, breathing, created by their creator people with God-given rights as opposed to privileges and immunities are on board that airplane. And the legal difference is key. So here's Hitlery telling you that an unborn child doesn't have rights. Well, why not? Because it hadn't been born. And the creator defines when its life begins. Trouble is, let's just not confuse ourselves. It ain't the same creator. It's not the same person. Persons don't have souls. People do. Wow. So what's interesting to me about stories like this is, here is somebody in a position of authority, just like Adolf, right? What is Adolf saying? What was the claim of the Nazi Reich? What was the claim of Pol Pot? What are the claims of the people that are saying Allahu Akbar and dispatching the infidels to their graves? What are they saying? You are not people. You don't deserve to live. My name is Adolf or Stalin or Idi Amin, I am the arbiter of all life and death. I will tell you when your life begins. There's one God. His name is not Adolf. His name is not Hillary. His name is not Stalin. His name is not Molech or Baal, which is coming to New York and London or any of those other things. We're talking about what? The tahor and the tamei, whether we are choosing the life force or the death force. And every single alternative creator who claims to give life. Well, what was the first lie in Genesis, right? You will not die. You can live forever. You can be like God. What's the lie we're hearing today? Well, we can transplant your very essence into a machine if you're part of the elite. We can extend life indefinitely. Hey, we got this great thing. You know it's coming, right? The mark. It'll fix what's ailing you. We can fix you with medicine. We can grow new organs. We can give. We just make sure you're serving the right God. But the unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights. It's one of the few times where her lips were moving, and what came out was Satan's honest truth. We just need to remember that. Other stories. Now, some of these are just literally within the last 24 hours. And I saw this story up on True News. I always like to cite sources, but you'll find it all over the web, I'm sure, this morning. Another. How many are we going to have? Active shooter at a disarmed killing field. Which disarmed killing field? Well, you know, the ones that used to be highly armed. Air Force bases, Army bases. How many times will we hear about major shootings at Air Force bases, Army bases, and similar nowadays? When we started doing really, really stupid things. Like taking soldiers and saying, you can't defend yourself. Die! Why? Well, because we're choosing the Tamei. Active shooter situation in San Antonio at Lackland Air Force Base. At least two have been killed. Later, the airman, after he had completed his mission, shot dead his squadron commander and then turned the gun on himself. So in most of these cases where the little satanic host here goes and does whatever it is that they're commanded to do, it ends up that way. That way there's nobody to testify about what particular SSRI drugs they were taking or how it is that they had been talked into doing this or whatever it was that was alien, whatever death force was driving them. Anyway, I won't give you the details. Took place yesterday. And the Army's chief of staff went before the Senate's Armed Services Committee and lied. Said, carrying guns on military bases won't stop the shootings. Well, it might not stop the first one, but it might stop the subsequent ones, and it might deter all of them. Well, anyway, General Mark Milley, as reported by the Washington Free Beacon, said he is strongly against carrying private guns on military bases in spite of the rash of recent shootings at the Washington Navy Yard, the Fort Hood massacre, where the Allahu Akbar shouting major killed. Remember, it was called workplace violence by the liar in chief. Wasn't Islamic terror. No, it was workplace violence. Anyway, so you got Fort Hood and last year's killing at the recruiting station in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where everybody was conveniently disarmed. So this guy, this so-called general, I'm going to say it, an idiot, or is he really that stupid? I don't believe it. He's strongly against carrying private guns on military bases because he's obviously strongly in favor of hanging on to his position and keeping his pension. This guy went on to say, listen to this, folks. He says, there's not a problem here. He was commander of the 3rd Corps during the Fort Hood incident. Oh, well, there you go. No wonder he gets his promotion. And he touted that it only took local police 8 minutes to respond to this latest situation, which he said was very fast. 8 minutes is a long time if somebody's killing you and everybody around you. This is idiocy. This is sheer idiocy. In California also, midweek, the California Attorney General conducted an armed raid against the home of one David Daladin. Anybody know that name? I'd heard it, couldn't place it. And he basically seized all of the undercover video footage that this man had shot and had on hand and had acquired concerning the Planned Parenthood sale and harvest of aborted baby parts. So, we're going to continue to subsidize Planned Parenthood. That kind of boiled over nicely, didn't it? And then went away. But those that dared to bring this information public, Achtung, you will be punished and we will steal the evidence too. Hillary Clinton was interviewed She was asked, do you think there's ever a chance in hell that you will face criminal proceedings? Ha 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 ha! She laughed and responded saying, that's not gonna happen. There's not even the remotest chance that that is gonna happen. Can you believe this hubris? If there was Zara Ott, I think she would have erupted into white right there on the stand. That's not going to happen either. Quote, they've been after me for 25 years. I've been getting away with it for a quarter century. You think I haven't proven that I know better than they do how to break the law? And as I've said many times, you know, if there's anything in post-constitutional America that ought to qualify her to wield the imperial pen, it's that. I mean, how much better can you get than a person who has proven by their fruit for a quarter century that they can lie and that they can commit murder and treason and felonies that the average person would have gone away for a long time ago and laugh about it and rub people's noses in it? You're looking for the tyrant who can take away people's guns and kill millions? I rest my case. At Oxford, one of the world's oldest theological seminaries. Now, you know, I often refer to these as cemeteries anyway because they haven't been teaching the right thing for years. But they're no longer even paying lip service. This is from the Christian Post out of Great Britain. And it says they're deviating, Oxford is, the seminary from its 800-year-old tradition in order to remain relevant to the dramatic change in the UK. After the first year, theology students will be allowed to skip any study of Christianity or the Bible, and instead they can choose wonderful, more appropriate modern subjects like feminist approaches to theology and religion or Buddhism in time and space. We have to recognize that people come with diversity, right? We no longer teach the difference between the Tahor and the Tameh. They have legitimately different interests. Quote, the major driver for change for theology and religion is the dramatic change in the way religion is seen and practiced in the UK, said the chairman of the theology faculty. This is a good reason why I would suggest that if you're talking about going into the priesthood, why? I'm going to say this word again. Why the hell would you waste your time going to a cemetery school where you can learn about all the things that are death force oriented? Ah. All right. The big story this week had to do with what I would call the major financial false flag of the last decade or so. Most everybody's heard about it. Last night I asked the question. There were a few people that hadn't, so we'll at least give you the quick background. There was a company in Panama, a law firm, that had the confidentiality, the lawyer-client, the attorney-client privilege violated. They got hacked, and 11.5 million documents, over 2 terabytes worth of data, was stolen. And some of the world's wealthiest, and in fact, a lot of the world's middle class, have now been outed. Was called Mossack Fonseca. Here's the part that doesn't get much reporting, and I mentioned this story. I give credit to a guy that I think is pretty well on the ball, Wayne Madsen, former intelligence insider, and he wrote an article that came out earlier this week saying, look, here's what people aren't being told about this. Not only are all of these leaker and all of the people that are associated with making this big PR splash, not only are they insider connected, these are George Soros funded organizations, these are left leaning infamous so-called liberal papers and foundations, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the ICIJ, the USAID, which is in fact linked with the Central Intelligence Agency. But get this. Here's what people aren't aware of. They sat on this information for 2 full years. This is not news. This leak happened in 2014, and they just now decided, ha-ha, it's time. Get the PR all in place and pop it loose. And within literally days of all of this being properly scheduled and released right according to plan, the Treasury Department came out and said, you know, we've had some rules that we wanted to put in place, Achtung, It wasn't enough that you don't have any financial privacy in the United States. We want to take that worldwide. We want to make sure that when, well, we decide nobody will buy or sell without permission, that we can enforce it already. And I remember years ago, what was it, probably 10 years ago, being down in Costa Rica, trying to just set up a bank account, and being told in Espanol about a form, and it was called Conoce su Customer. Know your customer. Hey, does that sound familiar? That was a U.S. Big Brother federal initiative, unconstitutional as it may be, foisted on branch banks all over the world a decade ago. So don't kid yourself. This is not new. This move is old. It's just that they keep having to tighten the screws. We have FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and then we had FATCA, where the fat cats are the only ones that can get away with these kind of stuff. Notice that in this unprecedented leak called the Panama Papers, there were no high-level, former folks like Bob Doles or, Molech forbid, John McCain or a Barry Sotero or a Hillary Clinton. Hey, how many millions are being laundered through the Clinton Foundation? Answer? Well, they know better than to do it through Mossack Fonseca, don't they? She's got Uranium One and all kinds of other stuff. Turns out that if you go look at the Clinton dead list and recognize names like Vince Foster, I did a story on this earlier in the news this week. There was something called PRISM. And before that, it was called Promise. This was software that was CIA developed, at least funded and directed. The Rose Law Firm had a lot of things associated with it, and it had to do with going out and being able to infiltrate various money transfer software systems worldwide. We talk about SWIFT and all these various things. In other words, the ability to transfer money internationally has been tapped and run by some of the insider criminals for a long, long time. This is not new. So the news this week was Treasury Department said there's still a few little loopholes out there. They've already said that anybody in the world that is dealing with dollars, you take the fiat money, we got you. Now they want to tighten the screws and complete, the ability to lock it all down. So they've got new things that they want to push. In an unscheduled, appearance in the White House briefing room, Barry Sotero just happened to be walking down the hall, saw a bunch of press there, and said, hey, maybe this is a good time to talk about, quote, important stuff, and how the issue of global tax avoidance was a huge problem. Problem is, a lot of this stuff is legal, not illegal, yet. You have to be above the law, in other words, if you really want to be able to do the kind of things that we're doing. And he talked about the basic communist principle of, quote, making sure everyone pays their fair share. So I guess bottom line here is we ought to know. This was planned. It's been in the hopper for 2 years. And when the financial false flag is necessary, out it comes. All right. Question on the screen. I see this one. If we're not obeying Yah's instructions, are we denying him? I guess I would say yeah. Ultimately, and here's the question. This is why I led this discussion off with this idea of persons versus people, and how, well, I'll quote Joshua 24:15. Choose this day whom you will serve. Elijah said almost the same thing on the day that he confronted the priests of Baal. If God be God, if Yahuwah be Elohim, serve him. But hey, if not, go for bail, man. Just know that there's a price associated with it. So we have an entire world system, I mentioned this frequently, that's based on dishonest weights and measures. Abomination. I talked about on Thursday, and I'll play this in a little while, the Come Out of Her My People show this week. And the line was from Micah, the prophet Micah. And the prophet Micah says, I'll just read the key here. At the end, close to the end of the book of that particular prophet, he says, he's shown you, meaning Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, oh man, what is good? And what does Yahuwah require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before your Elohim. And he goes on to talk about how his voice cries out to the city, wisdom shall see your name. Hear the rod, who's appointed it? Are there still treasures stored up in the house of the wicked? The fruit of their wickedness? You betcha! How about the short measure that is an abomination? In other words, dishonest weights and measures. Shall I count pure? Shall I count tahor? Those with the wicked scales and the bag of deceitful weights? For her rich men are full of chamas. Her inhabitants have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. Is there anything about that that doesn't just scream exactly what we're talking about in this Torah portion? Again, that's Micah 6. I know somebody's going to ask. Micah 6, essentially 8 through 9 through 12. This is not a new theme. It's not a theme that the Torah doesn't talk about over and over again. We have a choice. I've laid before you this day life and blessing, the tahor and the tameh, death and cursing, so choose. And it's an open book test. He says, choose life, that you and your children might live. And all around us, we see a society that chooses death from its abominations of weights and measures. And I think when we see things like this, I've got two more stories here. I'll do this quickly. This one came out within the last couple of days as well. Dave Kranzler, Investment Research Dynamics, essentially saying, look at some of the things you can see in the international currency markets. The dollar versus the yen. Dollar has been strong, right? It's the strongest. It's the best house in a bad neighborhood. It looks good, in other words, only compared to the other crap that's out there that looks even worse. And if you can keep a lid on the price of gold and silver, how? By turning paper gold and paper silver into what looks like the real thing and convincing people that the price of paper gold is somehow associated with the real stuff. Anyway, so what Kranzler said is the dollar to yen, the dollar began to break down against the world's, one of the world's worst currencies at the end of last year. And in the last week, it plunged big time, plunged below the key 110 level, and crashed on Wednesday, 1.4%, which is a huge move. Basically, what he said is something really ugly is going on. Other folks are saying, yeah, we're seeing this around the world. They're telling us recovery is coming real soon now. And yet, here's another headline from Brandon Smith, lost faith in the central banks and the economic endgame. Something is rotten in Denmark. Deutsche Bank is literally a ticking time bomb. Its balance sheet is a nuclear time bomb. Says Kranzler. And all of this says something really ugly is coming. Well, guess what? So does the Panama Papers. They had it for 2 years. They chose to release it this week. Can't tell you how many stories I'm seeing. Now, I know people predict the end all the time. And if there's one thing that I have suggested that we're going to understand and need to be aware of, it's that when it comes to the economic meltdown, right, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no CNBC reporter there to report on it, was there sound? If the economy collapses month after month and unemployment is really 25%, but you're told that it's not, is it a recovery or not? If retail sales collapse and yet you go see empty malls and you see that all these various big retailers are shutting down their stores, but they tell us on TV that if you believe that, you're peddling fiction. Right? What's the truth? Answer? The truth is the cancer is eating out the entire internals and people are oblivious to it. I have said for a long time, most folks won't wake up and realize how far gone the economy is. They keep thinking, oh, I know, I'll see it the day the Dow collapses 500 points. That'll tell me. Okay, and this is exactly what the story from Brandon Smith is saying. As long these fools in the plunge protection team and the Federal Reserve and the Bank of International Settlements have realized, as long as they can keep the stock markets propped up and keep people convinced that that's all that matters, they can literally rob them out of house and home. And they'll say everything's fine. So don't be holding your breath waiting for the big one to come, because the big one probably won't come. And when it does come, you won't hear about it on CNBC. But when it comes to the choice of the tahor and the tameh, the signs and the signals are all out there. Not only, for example, the Temple of Baal, the Arch coming to New York and to Trafalgar Square in London, but the UN's going to bring 1,000 of these abominations to cities all over the world. How's that for what's coming? Meanwhile, Barry's puppet master, arguably the evil behind the throne, the Svengali, the Rasputin behind the imperial pin, Valerie Jarrett, said this week that we have to eliminate gender biases in children's toys. So it's not enough that Big Brother wants to control every aspect from birth to death and demand that if you worship the God of the Bible, we're going to ram gay marriage down your throat and we're going to punish your licensed business, you cake baker and you wedding photographer, you. No, if you're Mattel and you make children's toys, we're going to demand that they not only be gender unbiased, they need to be gay, transgender, whatever crap we've got planned next, friendly. She said the following, quote, this was to a group of so-called business leaders. We know so many of our young children have those biases. Yeah, they, you know, their parents read the Bible, for crying out loud. We haven't gotten rid of that yet. And it's our collectivist responsibility to try to change the culture. Changing the culture isn't easy, and it doesn't happen overnight. But, you know, if we have to kill a few million people to bring that about, they're planning on it. She says the idea occurred to her because of how much difficulty she was having finding a Halloween costume and appropriate gifts for her little it. Now, why do I say her little it? Well, the daughter actually gives a gender here. And, of course, the article gives a gender. And that is verboten. We got it. We know. Now they have she, right? You can't say he or she. You have to say she if someone is transgendered. And I don't know how many official genders they're recognizing at the Molech level at the White House now. But it's up into the dozens of genders. Somebody who is a woman, likes guys, but really likes dogs instead. You know, they got a gender for everything. So, there weren't a lot of alternatives, she said, for Halloween costumes that were gender neutral. And encouraged my little, you know, nameless and sexless and to be determined later, whatever it is, to dream and think, you know, in a more appropriate way. What are we talking about? We're talking about a choice that literally says, you know, the God of the Bible, male and female, he created them. No, no. No, we're gonna let the Tamei literally rule over what toys will be allowed in a formerly free society to be given. Am I allowed to say to little boys and girls? This is how far gone things are. It's part of the reason why, you know, we talk about some of these words. This is beyond clean and unclean, folks. This isn't just insidiously satanic stuff. This is literally death force that is out there doing things to people that they're not aware of. Here's case in point number, 75. This is from Arne Gundersen, nuclear engineer that I actually have some respect for because he's been talking about what's really happening with Fukushima for three years at this point. Alarm bells are going off all over the Pacific, he said, concerning the plume of radiation coming to the U.S. West Coast from Fukushima. People will soon be dying from the radiation that's flowing across the Pacific. Massive amounts of nuclear waste are flowing into the ocean every day, and they will for more than a century. Quote, we've contaminated the biggest source of water on the planet. There's no way to stop it, he said. The monumental, shattering conclusion of all of this is that radiation knows no borders. What you can be sure of is that somebody, lots of somebodies, are going to die from the radiation in the Pacific. But you just won't know who it is. And they, meaning the nuclear people that are doing all of this and covering it up, they're counting on that. The nuclear establishment is saying, well, we can smear that out in a broader epidemiological study. In other words, see, you can't prove that radiation killed that person or those hundreds over there. Why, it could have been they smoked. Could have been they did a whole bunch. Could have been the GMOs that were putting in their food. You can't tell what it is that we did that killed them. And that's one of the satanically evil things about the death plan. I will frequently talk about what's called, among experiment designers and engineers, the two-factor interaction problem. And I mentioned the Chinese conducted a test years ago where they killed tens of thousands of dogs and cats all over the United States with a two-part poison. Remember this? You locals remember this? Melamine was part of it. What they did is they put different kinds of pet things, and in one of them they put this basically benign chemical, melamine. It was used as a filler. It's just a bulk thing. Makes it look like the dog or the cat is eating more food, but it has no nutritional value. Melamine. Well, the melamine would go into their internal organs and stay. And I forget if it was liver or kidney. I want to say kidney. The melamine would go into the kidney. It would be absorbed. It wasn't of any nutritional value, but the kidney would store this stuff up. Then they put the second part of the poison out, and they introduced that into the same dog and cat food. Now, they can claim later it was an accident, because, hey, who's going to know? And the second ingredient, the two-factor interaction, immediately caused crystals to develop in the kidney, and the dog and the cats died within hours. Horrible, painful deaths. And it took a long, long time to even figure out what had happened. And the people that did it were able to say, oh, wow, what a horrible tragedy. Guess we made a mistake. The point is this, and I hearken back to my days as an engineer. I worked with one of the most brilliant, this guy was the chief statistician of IBM. Wonderful fellow. And took some of his classes and got a lot out of them. But he would say, basically, you can design experiments, and we can design experiments to tell you if, you know, smoking causes cancer. He didn't use that example because he was a chain smoker. But he had all, you know, a million different things. If you want to improve the life of lasers, I can design experiments to tell you exactly. I don't have to know anything about physics, but I can design an experiment. And he did, and he proved all of this with what he was doing. Amazing stuff. To optimize variables. And I liked his approach. He called it theology for experiment designers, because he says God knows how to make the perfect whatever widget that you want to make. He knows exactly what the elements are in God's equation to make that the best widget it could be. You don't. But as a designer, your goal is to kind of come up with an experiment where you mess with the variables and determine what the best coefficient is for making your widget the best it can be by determining what God's equation is as best you can. See, he knows the equation, you don't. You're supposed to find it out. So, it's easy if you change a variable and you can see an effect. You can change a whole bunch of variables and see the effects and mathematically, and this is what his forte was, determine how to do things. But, if there are two factors that are interacting and causing the problem, it's like searching for a needle in a haystack. You'll never find it. You put factor A by itself, you change it all over the place, nothing happens. You put factor B by itself, change it all over the place, nothing happens. You put melamine in the dog food, nothing happens. You put the separate activating chemical in the dog food, nothing happens. The dog has both of those things in its body at the same time. Dead just like that. Now, ask yourself the question. If you're an insidiously evil, satanic, Molech-worshipping, Hitler-loving, let's kill all kinds of, well, fill in the blanks, non-persons, people that we don't like their God, how can you do it? Answer? We are really clever. Vaccines, genetically modified Frankenfoods, hell, a thousand other things that we can put into the food and the air and the water, and people will absorb all of this stuff and not know that they're a walking, ticking time bomb until we introduce the second activator to the water or the air or the food supply. And guess what? We can test it. We can test it in a little town in Michigan, outside of Detroit. We can test it in 100 different ways and see how well it works. And then when we want to, we'll unleash it. We can kill lots and lots of people. This is the kind of thing that's going on. It's part of the Lashon Hara. In other words, we're going to kill people. They've been coming right out and saying it. They're telling people how they're going to do it. They just haven't said when. And yet all of these insidious things, from destroying their immune systems to destroying their faith in the only true God in the universe, are continuing apace. Windows. You haven't heard about Windows 10. Turns out that not only does it have evil back doors, it's also stealing your bandwidth and not telling you about it. They've introduced something which is called a torrent-like system, where Windows literally, without telling the users what it's doing, will use people's computer and their internet connection to download itself, kind of like a virus, to other computers. You see, Microsoft had a problem. They're telling people, oh, you can get the wonderful Windows 10, a window into everything you do. It's a window that NSA has into your house, right? And it's 3.5 gigabytes of download. So it takes a lot of servers. It's expensive to download all this stuff. So what they do is they get people to download it, and then later they use their computers, unbeknownst to them, to upload it and download it to others. So Microsoft doesn't have to pay for the servers. Isn't that clever? Isn't that insidious? Is that dishonest? Yeah. Is it illegal? No. It's just crooked. Loretta Lynch Mob, Attorney General, wages total assault against nutritional supplements, said a story from Natural News earlier this week. They basically have produced a video about supplements for the National Consumer Protection Week. Talk about, you know, a lie written in print there. The video basically says, you know, people are eating all this natural, healthful stuff. Oh, be afraid, be very afraid, because the Food and Drug Administration has not approved it. Now, we've approved aspartame and other neurotoxins. We will approve vaccines. We will approve, oh, Big Brother will approve almost anything as long as it has the proper effects on your body. We could care less if a few people die due to, you know, vaccines or genetically modified frankenfoods or any of that kind of jazz. No, no. But if it's got to do with healthy stuff that we don't yet regulate, now we're talking something serious. So basically, the story just goes on and says, look, this is the kind of stuff that's going out. They quote the Alliance for Natural Health USA, an advocacy group that says, you know what? Dietary supplements have to this date caused zero deaths. The same cannot be said of the mass suicide and murder drugs like Prozac and Zoloft and other SSRIs. Can't be said of the various vaccinations. Can't be said of all of these other FDA, especially, right, aspartame, arguably the most deadly neurotoxin ever approved by a Big Brother agency. All right, let's pause. Because what I want to do is just to suggest, all right, we've talked about a number of things. This issue of Lashon Hara is a really big deal. And it's an important deal because of the story that I'll throw out, and whether we go through it or not is kind of up to, you know, how we're doing for time and questions and so forth. I saw yet another story saying something that I've said for a long time, and this guy's Doug Casey. I like Doug Casey. At least when it comes to economics, and people like Jim Willey and others that I've quoted already today, the Greater Depression has already started. It's been in place for a long time. He goes through a piece-by-piece comparison of the 2016 time frame with the 1930s. And it's about a 9-page article, and it's really pretty good, describing how things are similar and how things are different than the Depression of the 1930s, and how it is that while nobody can predict with certainty that this Depression will be like the last one, it's not going to be an instant replay. There'll be some big differences. For one, in the 1930s, there were huge amounts of farmland and family farms. There was an outlet where people could go and say, hey, we'll work for food rather than starve. Today, they don't have to work. We got welfare. We don't need to work. We don't have to have skills. Don't have to be able to clean out a horse stall or harvest a corn crop or do anything like that. Besides, it's not corn anyway anymore. All of this has made a number of changes. He points out that given how many people think that they got welfare instead, that'll decrease the production of new wealth, and simultaneously, because people don't have to go out and work to feed their families, delay the recovery. So whereas businesses were able to stay in business by offering some wage, any wage, better than nothing, no, I can't afford to pay you minimum wage. We didn't have a minimum wage in the 1930s. But at least you get money to stay fed, and I get to stay in business, but not anymore. So people will stay unemployed, employers will go out of business, and so forth. So what he's pointing out is that this depression is not going to be like the last one. There'll be some major differences, including the fact that America is very, very different in terms of no longer rural and farm-oriented, and a lot more people will die, and the economic situation will be dramatically different. And so for those reasons, that's part of the reason why I keep coming back to this idea of community and what's happening and how we have to be able to deal with one another. And you know what? As things get ugly, people tend to get ugly. And I guess that's the biggest concern. If there is ever a time to understand the difference between the life force and the death force, between Tahor and Tamei, and to be able to do things like what Matthew 18 says, you got a problem with your brother, go to him. If you can't go to him, what the hell is wrong with you? Something. There is a lot of discussion, and I didn't spend any time on it today, that you can talk about with the question of the evil tongue. Because one of the things that the sages will point out, and I think one of the things that Yeshua is pointing out too, because he, of course, is the sage, de tutte sages, is that, you know what? My grandmother used to say, if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. And there's a lot of truth in that. On the other hand, sometimes shutting up is not the right answer either. You got to avoid Lashon Hara. But as Yeshua points out, you know, if your brother has wronged you, you don't go talking to somebody about him behind his back, and you don't shut up about it either. You go to the person. If there are people at a federal level, at a national level, that are lying to people and getting ready to kill tens of millions, I believe you better speak up about it. If Hitler is planning on disarming tens of millions, well, all of them, and as a result, being able to say, now we can send you into concentration camps. We can tell you to eat the crap that we're telling you to eat. When we say bend over, we're going to stick you with this needle. And no, you non-person, you don't have any right to know what's in it. Just bend over. We need to be able to say, well, as my father used to say, the answer's not no, it's hell no. Don't do it. But the point is to speak up. So we have a tongue. We have the ability to speak words. Our Creator gave us that ability for a reason. The tongue is truly a fearful weapon. Use it. Use it the way He gave it to us to be used, not for evil, but to speak life. And the difference really is that key. So let's close with prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we come before you. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the chance together, both in person, even if it's small groups, and even if it's not as often as we might appreciate the chance to do so. And we thank you for the chance together online. We thank you for the technology and for the communications that is available for as long as it is that you'll allow it to be available to us. Help us to use the things that you have given us, including our tongues and our mouths and the languages that we have, to speak life and not death, blessing and not cursing. Help us to choose the Tahor rather than the Tamei. Help us, Father, to heal the rifts that divide us in the communities and the families. Abba, we lift up those of our loved ones and our families that are walking in rebellion and pray that you would chasten them. We pray that there would come a day then, too, when your miraculous chastening would be in place. Use the natural things, we pray, as well. People, witnesses, events, diseases when necessary, plagues of whatever form. Because we would far prefer to have our loved ones turn while there is time. Because we know, too, that it's not your will that any should perish, but that all would turn, make teshuva to you. Let it be, we pray, let it be soon. Heal our houses, heal our families, heal our communities. Bring us together. Help us to be counted worthy to escape these things that are so clearly coming. We know there's a harvest coming too, and we know that there aren't enough workers to do what needs to be done. Bring those, all of us, together. This we ask in your name, by your authority, by the authority of your word and your truth. Help us to choose life. We thank you and we praise you. For you alone are Kadosh. You are our Creator, our Redeemer, our King, our Savior, our Master, our Husband. Praise ye Yah. Hallelujah. Amen.